sir. I can't replace the plant just because you killed it.
I did not kill this plant. It was sick or something. I gave it everything. I was talking to it, telling it stories. I drew a sketch of it and put it on my refrigerator.
I water it.
I have this important that I did not kill this plant. You understand? So if you're just saying that because that's how you're making your excuse, you have to understand this. You can't mess with, I'm never gonna get laid. You obviously don't care. And that's one thing I do, is care. I feel sorry for all the plants in here. Going home. I killed the plant.
Okay.
I killed the plant.
It's okay. You still have your dog.
I don't even think he likes me. I just... What are you doing here? It's so good to see you.
A guide to the Echo River for drifters and pilgrims. This guide is a public service provided by the Bureau of Secret Tourism. For a menu of our resources, press 1. If you have an extension to dial, press 9. For more information about our organization, press 3. If you don't remember dialing this number at all, press 5. To hear these options again, press. So, you don't remember dialing this number. You just sort of woke up with the phone pressed to your ear, ringing on the other end. Or maybe you thought you'd dialed a different number, but your digits betrayed you. Or there's a faulty connection somewhere out there in that spiderweb lattice of phone cords that covers all of creation. It must be kind of a nice feeling, really. It's like you and I just bumped into each other in the street or a little cafe. Say, next time you meet a stranger, call us back at extension 7864 and hand them the phone. We'd love to get to know them. Welcome home.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Plants for People 2 podcast. This is episode 13, and today we're going to be talking about a few wetland plants. One of the reasons is that they're still ideable right now during the wintertime when most plants are not in their vegetative state. They've all gone dormant, but these plants happen to have wintertime dormant vegetation above the snow that you'll be able to see. And so hopefully you'll learn something new about both of these genera and be able to ID them when you see them on your own property or while you're out. It'll give you a little perspective on how widespread some invasive plants are, and also what to look for if you think that you might have the native species in your location. So the first one we'll just jump right in. The first one is Phragmites, and so we'll just do a quick ID, similar to the madcap horse scenario in the last episode. This is an easy way to remember different types of groups of plants when you're trying to ID it in the field, and a way to differentiate them from something else. So sedges, grasses, and rushes can all look very similar, and the way to do a quick ID check on these is to take a look at the stem. And so if the stem is hollow, it's likely a grass. And also the ID tool or remembering characteristic is grasses have joints. So you can kind of remember that, like, you put grass into a joint, grasses have joints. The stems are also hollow in the majority of cases. If the stem is solid and you can roll it between your forefinger and thumb, and it's round, it's probably a rush. And if it doesn't roll easily and it's angular, like a triangle, that's characteristic of sedges. So grasses have joints, rushes are round, and sedges have edges is the characteristic you want to remember there when you're out in the field trying to ID some of this stuff. And so the Phragmites falls into the grass category, and so it's in the Poaceae. And so this very tall grass, sometimes they're up to 15 feet tall, can be seen in wetlands, marshes, wetter areas, any sort of, like, you see it very frequently on 495, you know, any highway where there's been sort of wetland remediation, or there used to be a wetland there and they did a lot of earth moving. This Phragmites australis is a very common occupier of those sites due to the disturbance. And so, you know, thinking about this invasive plant, which came here in the 1700s, they think, possibly the 1800s, in ballast water of ships from Europe. So, you know, a cargo ship taking on water to balance themselves out, and then when they come back, they drop all that water. And so in that was whatever wet area, the seeds of whatever plants were around that wet area that they were in. And it's happened before with, I think it's zebra mussels, which is now a common invasive arthropod in it's probably the Hudson River. And I know I've seen it in Lake Bomazine in Vermont. So, and it's probably in Lake Champlain as well. I think I've seen some notifications of that. And so that's a one way that, you know, we've talked about some other ways that invasive plants get into areas where they're not native and sort of take off. The Phragmites australis didn't take off until around the 1900s. And it sort of was around the Atlantic coast, and then it moved inland and westward, and it can now be found in, at least the map I looked at had Idaho and Georgia off that, but I would imagine that it's there. Maybe the invasive sort of plant task force criteria are different in those states, but it is all over the United States, and in great quantities in most cases, at least where I've had experience trying to remediate areas where Phragmites has taken over. Out of Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, it occurs in, you know, all along the roadways. It gets patchier as you get sort of further north and away from any sort of big construction, development, stuff like that. So you will see it in small cases, you know, sort of like in the middle of nowhere in quotations. And but for the most part, it's inhabiting the wetlands and areas of disturbance where a lot of that is taking place. One of the most recent places I worked where it was pretty infiltrated was in Mendon, where they're putting the new Green Mountain National Forest office. They had me go in there and do a little work there before they did any more construction. And then the other one was up in Aalborg, and that one in particular was a tough place to be working with Phragmites because it's so dense, and it can be very dense when it's wall to wall. And what will happen is every year the canes sort of die back and they get very brittle. They're also very sharp and hard. So they break over and they sort of form this thatch on the wetland there. And it sort of smothers any other native vegetation that would be coming up in that wetland area. And it will outcompete shrubs, and it sort of forms a monoculture where nothing else is growing. And then you can have it where, you know, the population of the invasive plant is maybe 50% or 50% of the total vegetation or less. And in that situation, especially in Aalborg, it was more of like a hunting scenario where you're looking for this very tall, you know, the wetland vegetation, the shrubs are over your head. And in that particular area, it was a bunch of poison sumac over your head. But you're looking up through the shrub canopy trying to find the tassels. They're usually, when they start tasseling, they're like a reddish purple brown color. And then as they get older, they sort of turn a more pale yellow, almost a white or a beige. And so you'd be looking up through the canopy trying to find those and then trace that back down to where the stem was actually growing, where you could access it and cut it down and treat it. But so they, unfortunately, this plant occurs in very hard to access sites sometimes. And there have been some studies that have looked at this plant as a heavy metal remediation tool in pulling heavy metals out of areas where, like brownfields, where they've been dumping chemicals for a long time, or there was some sort of you know, manufacturing site there, and maybe they buried it, and it's been thought to do that. But I think, you know, there are other, and we'll talk about one in a minute, a more native plant that could be used for a similar type of thing. The other interesting thing that I learned about Phragmites a few years ago was that it is possible to synthesize DMT from the rhizomes. And the rhizomes are primarily the way I observe, and for the most part, I think this is a commonly understood thing, that they vegetatively propagate themselves. So if you took a piece of that root mass, that rhizome, and brought it somewhere else and planted it, it would grow new shoots. And you can look at populations of Phragmites australis growing in a wetland, and you can tell that they're sending out rhizomes from all these plants. So at least in some ways, you know, if they don't have very viable seeds, because they're in a situation where they're using waterways to transport their seeds, that would be part of their biological evolutionary process. But if the seeds aren't viable, then this plant at least can be semi-contained, where it's only propagating vegetatively from the root rhizome. And so then we just have to be careful that we're not moving that those plants anywhere else. So a lot of times you see this, like I said before, on highways and construction sites. And what happens is it comes in on machinery. And when that machinery is there for a couple of days, you know, those little fragments fall off and then they reestablish themselves once all the machinery's gone. And that's why you see in those big basins on like 495, it's wall-to-wall Phragmites. And so I was looking at plants that contain the DMT psychedelic molecule, and that was one of them, which was really interesting. I never tried to synthesize DMT from it, but you could, if you were so inclined, look it up on Google and see the directions out there or the paper to try to figure that out. Just be careful if you do harvest those things, make sure they're not ending up in any sort of habitat where they can take over and become more of a problem than they were where it already was. The native Phragmites americanus, I have seen this plant before. It is a rare plant in New England for the most part. Let me just pull up the treatment here for this. Okay, so it occurs in like the very top of Maine, the topper looks like Aroostook County, and into Oxford County, Androscoggin County, into New Hampshire, Stratford County. It looks like in Vermont it's only appearing in Addison County, on Cape Cod, and down into Washington County, Rhode Island, Middlesex County, Connecticut, and New London County, Connecticut. Overall, and you know, across the United States, it occurs from Maine all the way out to Washington and California. Part of the ID characteristic for this, where it's it, you know, looks very similar to the invasive Phragmites, and this is in part due to, you know, this adds to the rarity of this plant. It's not listed as rare in Vermont, which I find interesting. It's listed as rare in New Hampshire and in Massachusetts, it's unranked. So in Connecticut, it's extremely rare. In New Hampshire, it's extremely rare. Vermont, it's unlisted at all, although it is listed as present. And in Massachusetts, it's unranked. They think that this plant in particular, the American species, was targeted during a movement to try to take control of the invasive species, and due to the misidentification, may have eradicated some of these native populations of plants. So it's very important to be sure of what you're looking at, and hopefully, you know, with what you learn here today, you'll be able to go out there, and if you think you have the native species on your property or, you know, where you work or whatever, you'll be able to take a look at it and have some resources to look those things up and see if you can positively ID it as the native one. So some really clear points are, you know, one thing, the first one that I talk about a lot is knowing what invasive looks like. And looking at a population of a plant in a wetland, and you know, in some ways I'm contradicting myself because I said before, you know, the Phragmites can be wall-to-wall, 100% monoculture, and then it can be mixed in 50-50. And so it may be a situation where you get really good at seeing it while it's a monoculture, and then as you get out into the field and looking at different places, you can ID that species with what you know, because you're comfortable with looking at it in such high density. You've seen a lot of those plants and what it looks like. You'll at least be able to ask the question, is this plant? And maybe you'll be able to get there. So one thing is, take a lower leaf and off the stem and just peel it down, and you'll see right where the leaf is touching the stem, it's sort of clasping it. a little bit. And so what you can do is you can look at what are called ligules. And in the American one, the ligules are 1 to 1.7 millimeters long, as opposed to the ligules in the Australis species, which are shorter, 0.4 to 0.9 millimeters long. So this, you should be able to look at, if you know, look at a lot of invasive frag ligules and see, you know, get comfortable with what 4 to 0.9 millimeters looks like. And then, you know, if you ever see what you think is the American species, it will be, you know, almost twice as long, just under twice as long. So there should be a pretty distinct difference between those two. The other thing to remember is that the American species will have a reddish, red-brown, dark hue to the stem. And so you should be able to look at that stem and see that red-brown color during the growing season, and make that determination, because the invasive Phragmites species is a green, tan, sometimes it can almost be like a bluish color. So, you know, going out into the woods and making that distinction, getting comfortable with what the stems look like on that, can really help you to identify a native versus a invasive species like the Phragmites. So, I hope that was clear for everybody to sort of take that information and run with it. Next time you're driving on, you know, going to Eastern Mass or, you know, anywhere really, try to see those big, tall, 15-foot tall old tassels right now. But when the spring comes, you'll start seeing small sprouts coming up. And so those plants will completely regrow from their root rhizome, and they'll grow back to 15 feet tall. And then in August, they will start to tassel. Late July, August, September, they start to put up tassels. And so those are the flowers, the flowering stalks. And that's another good key indicator for IDing that species. That also happens to be the best time to treat them. So they can be, just like most other invasive situations, dealing with it when it's really small is the most economical and least impactful way to go. Because if you're hand pulling seedlings, you're doing very little turnover to the soil, very little disturbance. You're also not using any chemical, and it's, you know, you could do it in a weekend, or maybe you do it in a few hours if it's a really low density of plants. But knowing how to ID those plants is the best way to get ahead of that. So if you have a huge infestation and it's wall-to-wall, 100% acre upon acre of Phragmites australis, then you have... your options are limited, because doing any sort of mechanical control on that is going to end up turning over a lot of the soil. It might be in a really hard to get to area, so mowing might not be an option. And, you know, in that way, hand pulling it might not even be an option either. I've heard it's very difficult to do that. And so chemical control is probably going to be, you know, the option for you to take care of some of that. And they make wetland approved chemicals. And in the situation that we've been talking about with the frag, you know, because we know they're sort of all connected through rhizomes, you don't necessarily have to treat every single plant in that location. You can treat, you know, 70 or 80% of them, and you should be able to have a pretty good percentage of mortality within that population to start getting it under control. And then maybe the next year you're going in there and hand pulling any respreads that you see, because now you only have, you know, 10% of what was there before, and it's a lot more manageable than it was the first year. But you needed chemicals to get you there. And so if that is you, if you have a really high density Phragmites, what you're going to have to do is wait till your plants start tasseling before you do any treatment. And that is the August, September. You can do it up until October, but it has to be after flowering, and that's when you're going to get the highest success rate when using that sort of treatment method for that invasive plant. So let's transfer to another plant that also exists in this sort of habitat that we're exploring right now, which is like the wetland, marsh, pond sort of edge habitat, and that's the typha species or cattails. And so everyone should be really familiar with what cattails looks like. Cattail was probably one of the first plants that I can sort of remember, you know, sort of wondering about and playing with and lighting on fire. But I guess when I used to walk down to the bus stop as a kid, there was a little wetland next to that, and it was full of cattails. And so we would, in the fall, we would go in and break off the stems and make like a little wand with it, and you could like hit it on the ground, and they sort of like, you know, they blow up when you twist them or break them, and the flower heads that are all trying to go to seed, and then they sort of go everywhere and float away, and it's a pretty magical thing. And it, you know, it's still kind of a cool, you know, thing to wonder about, you know, at 37 and, you know, I don't know how many years that is later, but you know, that species, I just always thought of it as a, you know, a wetland plant. And, you know, it really, I didn't think that there would be multiple species of this, but in New England anyway, there are two of them. So two typha species in New England. The typha genus falls into the Typhaceae, which is a particular family for this plant, as well as burrweed. So that one, Sparganium is the genus name on that. And so Sparganium is a common wetland plant as well. And so those two have been grouped into the same family, the Typhaceae. And in New England, we have Latifolia, which is the broadleaf cattail, which happens to be the native one. And that's every county in New England, every state, wall to wall, even across the United States and Canada, this species can be found. And the other one is Angustifolia, which is a non-native, and that one is not necessarily non-native in every county across New England, although it is pretty much across the United States. And it occurs in every county in Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, southern New Hampshire, and then the coastline of Maine. And these two species can be hard to distinguish in the wild because they do have the ability to hybridize. But for the most part, you have the fruiting spikes on Latifolia, which is the broadleafed cattail, the one that we're most familiar with, the native one, 24 to 36 millimeters thick, and the widest leaves are 24 to 36 millimeters wide when fresh. And the Angustifolium, the non-native species, is fruiting spikes 13 to 22 millimeters thick and widest leaves 4 to 12 millimeters thick. So they're half to a third as wide as the latifolia species. So that's something to, you know, that's another one just like the frag going out there, taking a look at. Cattails are pretty easy to see from far away. It's an easy way to get yourself observing plants and the differences between certain plants. You can go out there, find cattails. It doesn't matter if it's one or the other. Bring a little measuring tape with you. You know, figure out what 4 to 12 millimeters looks like and what 24 to 36 millimeters looks like, and start taking a look at some of those leaves and see where they fall into those categories. And then start taking a look at some of the inflorescences from last season and see if you can get a sense for how thick they are. At least when I've seen these two species mixed in a wetland, and it is pretty obvious, at least to my eye, to see the skinnier inflorescences versus the thicker ones. Now, if you take one of those out of there, I would probably have to look at the leaves to get a sense for which species I was looking at, because they can be very similar and they can hybridize. So you could have, plants that have, you know, thinner inflorescences with thicker leaves and vice versa. So it's a little difficult to hash out. But you can at least get a sense for, you know, observing different characteristics of different species, that you would run into in the wild. Now, I posted yesterday about the typha and the phragmites, and I added in some posts of the typha species from different areas in the world, because worldwide typha has, I think it's 30 species, it might be more than that, but I included some from Europe and Asia. I think there's one there from Iran, and the purpose of that is just to show the species differences, what we've been talking about in terms of looking at this particular species is different because, and in some of those you can clearly see they look like corn dogs. Some of them are really round and small and short, and there's some of them that are a lot bigger, and there are a whole slew of different things that you could be looking at in terms of those species. I looked into a few of them, and I was pretty impressed with just the differences in just the flower structure, because that's all I could really visually see from those photos. But I'm sure if you saw them in person, there might be hairs on the other side of the leaves, or, you know, maybe the leaves have a particular shine to them, or there's a ligule at the base of the leaf that, you know, is a certain length versus the length of something else. And so those are the things that if you can pick up and start looking at those in the field, identifying them, and then you get comfortable with what those plants look like, you sort of observe, you know, the general idea of what that plant is, and you start recognizing it without having to check every time to see if that plant has that particular characteristic or not. Sometimes with hybrids, you'd have to look a little more closely, but it's a trait that you want to pick up observing these particular things and start asking what species is this, and, you know, start really drilling down into how do I figure these things out, because if you can tell the difference between the native versus the invasive. Got a phone call. Hold on. Okay. I didn't answer it. I just let it ring out. We don't really answer the house phone around here. Just, I don't even know why we have it. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the importance of common, cattails and what, you know, some uses for it, because it's all over the United States. It makes sense that it would have had a really high importance to indigenous people. And so I just want to look at some of the things, you know, that indigenous peoples would have used this plant for. And what I found was that, you know, unsurprisingly, they used it for, they used the, you know, we were talking about breaking open one of those inflorescences and they sort of just explode, in sort of like a flowy way. It's like a, it would be like squeezing a tube of toothpaste until it broke. It just sort of like oozes out, but they're dry. Everyone go get a cattail right now and break it. Anyone who doesn't know what I'm talking about. But, so those feathery seeds, were used for bedding. I'm sure that they were stuffed into, clothing for insulation, that they would probably make really nice insulation. I'm sure if you had enough of them, it would make a pretty decent bed as well. And interestingly, I found that it says it was mixed with ash, so wood ash, I assume, and lime, with the seeds, and they form a cement, and it was reported that that cement was harder than marble. So that's a pretty interesting thing. I might have to try that out this spring. It seems like it would be pretty easy to do, and see if that's accurate or not. And you know, you could do like a cordwood house or something cool with that. All of, you know, made from wood ash, lime, and cattail seeds. That sounds amazing. And it was also used for, indigenous people used it for thatch, for housing, floor mats, sandals. I know that it was also used as a food source. I think you can make a sort of like polenta with some of those, and I think the rhizomes are edible as well. They're like a almost like a carrot or a like a cucumber would be, and you might have to cook them. I know if you guys want to look it up, I think you can Google it on YouTube. Cattail, it's probably like edible cattail would get you there. But I watched a little documentary a couple of years ago about all the indigenous uses of the cattail, and I was very impressed with the number of things that plant was used for. And I might go out on a limb and say that that might be the most useful plant that I've seen in terms of like what you can do with it. I'm sure that somebody out there is like, no, this is this one is the most useful, but it just seems like there's a half a dozen, if not a dozen, different things that you can do with cattails. Oh, one of them was like frying up the flowers, like a fritter. And I bet they're probably good. I might have to try that, you know, next time they're just past flowering. I'll have to look up when the best time to do that is. But there's a lot of interesting information about there out there on YouTube. A lot of good visuals and a lot of things that you can try, especially if we're going to be, you know, going through these waves again. Hopefully this summer is, we finally get out of this shithole that we're in right now, but, and Omicron just goes away forever. But if, you know, things looking, a lot of people baked bread, it's, you know, going out there and taking a look at cattail and what you can do with it, would be a great thing to do. So the other, quickly touching on, Sperganium. This burr reed is interesting. I just found out that this was in this family while I was doing a little research on typha. But this is another important wetland plant. And it's, you know, I've observed it. I had some photos from Grafton. I think the one I posted yesterday was from Grafton, Vermont. And I've seen it all over up in Swanton. And, you know, clearly a really important habitat for some, you know, special birds up there who are using, like, the wetter drainages between all these sort of fields of grass for habitat. And I think that we're, I want to say a rail, but it's not a rail. It'll come to me. I forget. I have them here too where I live. There's a pair that come back every season, and they sort of make this really strange sound in the wetland. But so in New England, you've got Sperganium. You have 7 species, and the one that I posted was Americanium, which is probably the most common one. But, you know, another plant that is has really interesting flowers. They sort of appear in these... they almost look similar to, like, what a phylloctrum flower would look like, a meadow rue. Sort of has these firework inflorescences all around in a ball. And so when they're pollinated and they start going to seed, they actually become these very sharp looking, sort of like, they sort of look like a mace would, a medieval mace. You know, a ball with spikes all over it. And they form these, you know, when I've seen them, they've been in dense mats, you know, but thinking about the wildlife that inhabits these areas, a lot of times, you know, they've evolved to, think about a heron walking through an area where all these sort of reedy stems are, their legs, and, you know, they're part of what they do is they stand there very, like, still and wait for fish or an amphibian to come along. And if your legs look just like all the plant material around you, the prey that you're after isn't going to be able to tell the difference between your legs and the burr reed, say. And so it gives you an advantage. And so, like, these, it's amazing to walk out there and just think about how all of these plants and wildlife interact and, you know, moving towards a recognition of these species and, you know, who they are, what they are, and how they play a role in these ecosystems that we may or may not fully understand how they all work, but they've been here a lot longer than us. Like this, the typha or typhaceae family has been around. They have fossil records going back 145 to 66 million years ago, so that's Cretaceous period, and that's way longer than, you know, the human existence here is a blink compared to all of that. And all of those, you know, evolutionary advantages that have happened over the course of that time. And we're really just scratching the surface on what we even think we know about any of that stuff. So I hope that you guys are having a good Sunday. We're hopefully going to get back to doing some in-person interviews here. I have sort of a lot of irons in the fire right now, trying to set up some new content for the podcast. So, yeah, we'll be touching base very soon with those people, and hopefully next week we'll have something fresh and exciting from somewhere else in the country. But I appreciate all of you guys listening along, and I hope that you're learning something from this. And always feel free to reach out. Either you can DM me on Instagram, plants.people.r.2, T-O-O. You can also email plantsarpeople2podcast@gmail.com. You know, I'd love to hear if there's anything in particular you want me to talk about or anyone you want me to have on the show. I'm also open to doing plant ID if anyone's having sort of trouble IDing something in their local area. Just helps if I get, you know, a couple photos of leaves, bark, flowers, if it has them. And then location where the photo was taken is really helpful. But I'm always happy to do that and, you know, help everyone sort of move along their understanding of plants in the natural world. And just as a reminder, you know, at least here in Vermont, it looks like next week is going to be a sugaring week. So, you know, get your buckets up. It looks like it's going to be doing that for like 7 days or so, that temperature fluctuation. And what was the other thing I was going to say? Anyway, I hope you guys are doing good, and I'll see you next week. Thanks.